The same religion that's capable of hideous acts of destruction could also be capable of moments of healing, of restoration, and of hope.
But educate a girl, and you educate her entire family.
There is a son within every person.
When that anger sets in, write it. Write the letters, but don't send them. You never want to leave concrete proof of insanity.
Amy and I are on an 80-city tour that began a few weeks ago. And the tour is in honor of several things. First, it is in honor of, the title of our new book that was released just about a week ago called Static, Government Liars, Media Cheerleaders, and the People Who Fight Back. And it's that last part that people have been asking us at every stop. How do you keep any hope in the face of the things you're seeing? Well, it's looking out and seeing you here. It is the people who fight back part of what we write about that gives us hope. And the people doing just, you know, people are trying to make the world a better place in so many ways, big and little. Making a film like this that will do so much to break the sound barrier, as we call this tour, the sound barrier of the corporate media that has whitewashed the imagery that comes out of Iraq to make you think that it's little more than a video game, a push-button affair where there are no casualties, and where it's actually being fought for high-minded ideals. It's a little hard to think of what those ideals might be when we see those kids wounded in the hospital, the dead being offloaded from the truck. Well, another thing that gives us hope is something we did a little over an hour ago. We went and visited Arlington West. Many of you have probably seen it down on the beach. And I would like to acknowledge the members of Veterans for Peace, if you could stand, those of you who are here, who've been involved in the Arlington West Project. So when people ask us about this tour, we're going to be telling them about Santa Barbara. It was just incredibly moving to be down on the beach. Such a dignified and noble way to honor the sacrifices that have occurred, to put a visual image to the names, something that gave you a sense of what does 2700 mean. We can never know what those lives were, but even to begin to grasp as they marched off down the beach, each one demarcated by some absurd claim made by our leaders, mission accomplished at one point. That was only about 500 people dead. We're thousands dead since mission was accomplished, and then the other milestones that they mark, Saddam Hussein captured, and other, you know, essentially meaningless milestones that are part of what has really become a full-scale assault, a propaganda campaign in which the corporate media has not been tricked and duped, as we so often hear. How did the corporate media get it so wrong? Well, they have been a seamless and essential part of the propaganda machine that was cranked up on 9/11 and continues to this day. And I can say that because when we began our tour, we were deciding We were thinking about doing it on September 11th, just a few blocks from Ground Zero in New York City. And at first we thought, you know, maybe we should just avoid that whole 9/11 thing. Maybe we should do it on the 10th or the 12th. But the more we thought about it, the more important we felt it was that we need to reclaim September 11th for those who are fighting for peace and justice in this country. Because the tragedy that occurred 5 years ago began with hijackings of planes. And that tragedy has been compounded by the other hijacking that has occurred, and that is the hijacking of that tragedy to justify illegal wars, trampling on our Constitution, and substituting propaganda where news should be, and perhaps once was, and hopefully will be again, largely thanks to independent media. You know, you'd think with the experience of the last few years where the media didn't get it a little wrong, got it completely wrong, virtually every major aspect of the claims that were made were fraudulent. We knew it then and we know it now, but the media was acting not as a skeptical arm's-length watchdog of those in power, but as a conveyor belt for the lies of this government. And so, and this hasn't stopped. On September 11th, we had an event where we brought forth, in the heart of New York City, voices of hope and resistance and melodies of hope and resistance. We had the great jazz bassist Charlie Hayden and his Liberation Music Orchestra joined us, and Dar Williams, a wonderful musician, folk singer. And one of the people who also came and spoke that night was a man by the name of David Petorti. David lost his brother 5 years ago in the World Trade Center. And when he went to tell his mother that her son would not be coming home, after the initial shock, she said to him, "I don't want any other mother or any other family anywhere in the world to feel the kind of anguish that we feel now. You know, as our son, brother, loved one isn't coming home. Not in our name should anything be done by our government to inflict more pain and suffering and death on people anywhere." And so David founded a group called the September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. They are, these are the people who responded to the tragedies by calling for peace and reconciliation and building bridges instead of bombing bridges. They are some of the most eloquent and moving voices speaking, both then and now, about what has happened in this country. But you didn't hear them. You didn't hear them on the evening news. You didn't hear them unless you were tuning into KCSB or Democracy Now. And you didn't hear them because they didn't fit the mold of what the corporate media was looking for and what got you the headlines. What got you the headlines were if you were a father who was writing the name of his son or daughter on a bomb that was about to be dropped on Baghdad, having, of course, nothing whatsoever to do with 9/11. They could have been dropping it on Mexico City. You got to be on the evening news if you were a mother calling for revenge, calling for a full-scale assault on a country like Afghanistan, so poor and so helpless. And what exactly did this have to do with, you know, what happened on 9/11? But that's what got you on the news. And this was consistent with the debate that was going on about the Iraq War. Do you remember that debate? It was the debate between Democrats and Republicans. Oh, they both agreed that we should attack Iraq. So that was the debate in this country, hearing whether we should invade next week or in 2 weeks. And if you were part of what was in fact the majority of Americans who opposed the invasion, you were completely frozen out of the media. Well, I asked David now, 5 years later, and this is after the New York Times and Washington Post have all been forced to publish Well, we can't really call them mea culpas. They were kinda culpas. They admitted to getting things a little bit wrong, maybe. So I asked him, well, what's this day been like for you? And he said, well, it's been incredible. At 1:30 in the morning, I was doing an interview for BBC. A Japanese TV crew was here at 4 a.m. At 6 a.m., it was Norwegian TV. 11 a.m., the BBC was back. And I said, wow, and what about American media? And he just looked at me and shook his head. Not one, he said. 5 years later, years after we have had actual confessions from the mainstream media about its complete failure to cover what was really happening, these voices, the voices of peace, are still just too hot to handle for the corporate media. And we bring this fast forward in our book, Static, where we talk about how it's going now. And we'd like to think that this experience might be humbling, if not shaming, for those who have acted as a megaphone for our government. But as we write, the media just can't seem to shake its instinct to defer to power. In December 2005, the New York Times published a shocking expose by reporters James Risen and Eric Lichtblau. Their story revealed that following the 9/11 attacks, the Bush administration ordered the National Security Agency to begin wiretapping people inside the U.S., including U.S. citizens, in direct violation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978, which expressly forbids warrantless wiretaps inside this country. To read the article, you might have felt alarmed by the picture of creeping fascism that it describes. But you would have felt vaguely reassured that the press was on the job as a watchdog until you came to the ninth paragraph, which said, quote, the White House asked the New York Times not to publish this article, arguing that it could jeopardize continuing investigations and alert would-be terrorists that they might be under scrutiny. After meeting with senior administration officials to hear their concerns, the newspaper delayed publication for a year to conduct additional reporting. Some information that administration officials argued could be useful to terrorists has been omitted. So let's do the math. 13 months before this story was published, there was a national election, won by George W. Bush, the guy who ordered laws to be broken because he didn't feel he needed to answer to anyone. The last president to behave in this way was Richard Nixon. He faced a public outcry and was forced to resign in disgrace in the face of almost certain impeachment. Indeed, when the wiretapping story was finally published in the Times, it sparked congressional investigations and even calls for impeachment of the president for violating the law. It turns out the Times did, in fact, have this story ready to go before the 2004 election, but decided to wait at the request of the people running for re-election, who rightly feared how the public might respond to the revelations. Imagine, just for a moment, how different things might have been if this explosive exposé had been published when it was written. The Times delayed publication because it might, quote, jeopardize continuing investigations, ignoring, as the media watch group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting has pointed out, that placing illegal and unconstitutional programs in jeopardy is the whole point of the First Amendment. More astonishing was Times executive editor Bill Keller's explanation of why the story was delayed for so long. He said that the Bush administration had, quote, assured senior editors of the Times that a variety of legal checks had been imposed that satisfied everyone involved that the program raised no legal questions, close quote. Mind you, this is the regime of George W. Bush we're talking about, the folks who assured us that torture was legal, that preemptive war was legal, and that holding prisoners incommunicado in an offshore gulag was legal. But for the editor of the Times, it's enough just to take the government's word when it says something is legal. Well, maybe this explains a little bit of what we have encountered in our as we have toured around the country. Where this afternoon we were in Fresno, a place not known so much for its political activism, but we're facing a room there of hundreds of people coming out. A year ago when we were touring with our last book, The Exception to the Rulers, I remember going to Salt Lake City. Again, not a place really known for progressive thinking. And we're flying in, and I'm thinking, why are we even going here? I mean, it's not ski season. And we're going to, you know, there are going to be 30 people there. We'll be related to all of them by some genealogical... and we show up, and a hall for 700. Every seat is full. There are 300 people lined up outside the door, and the fire marshal is there trying to turn people away. And this is where I discovered another one of my big sister's talents was negotiating with fire marshals, which she has done on a number of places. What is going on? Well, I think probably what is going on in this room, the hunger for unembedded, honest, truthful reporting of what is going on in this world is just tremendous. People may not even know what they don't know, but they know they're not getting the whole story on the evening news. And I guess this may help explain why we learned this morning in the New York Times that our book has hit number 18 on the New York Times bestseller list. But this is where we need your help, because you wouldn't learn about our book from reading the pages of the New York Times, only from seeing their website. That's because they only publish the names of the top 15 books in the pages of the Times. Now, I'm not sure where the bad blood between us and the New York Times goes back to. It may have been that chapter in The Exception of the Rulers called The Lies of Our Times. But I really thought they'd gotten over that by now. I mean, they didn't review the book, and we don't expect them to review this book. And, you know, I think there's a few chapters in here where we don't talk specifically about some of the things that have been said in the New York Times. But so we just think, you know, if this would be a wonderful time to help get this book over the Berlin Wall that keeps things out of the Times, to get them to publish the name of our book, Meet Government Liars, Media Cheerleaders, and the People Who Fight Back, would be our little gift to Judith Miller and Ann Coulter and all the others. So this is a great time to do your holiday shopping, getting signed copies. Amy and I will be delighted to personalize and sign to some of you may recall a thing called public libraries. They used to be institutions that gave out free books when they could afford such things. Now you need to donate books to the library, and we'd be delighted if you would get a copy for your library. And you may not think your dog can read, but I'm here to tell you, when your dog is looking at you, he knows what's going on in the Bush administration and the corporate media. He just wants to see if you know, and that book would go a long way to that. So there's my pitch for what we can do after this. Since we've seen, you know, when we speak about propaganda and how throughout the book we have chapters on how the Bush administration has paid off journalists, had fake journalists, fake news that is being produced by different branches of the government that is being aired as news. This is not, you know, an accidental process. This is carefully and methodically both thought out and executed. So we have a chapter called News Fakers in our book about some of what's going on. And we begin it with a quote from one of our favorite journalists, I.F. Stone, who said, "All governments lie, but disaster lies in wait for countries whose officials smoke the same hashish they give out." By 2006, President Bush was presiding over a continuous string of scandals, policy failures, and public relations fiascos. His pet war had become a bloody quagmire. Hurricane Katrina had laid waste to the Gulf Coast and laid bare the incompetence of his appointed cronies. Bush's signature program for his second term, privatizing Social Security, hit a wall of public opposition and sank in a few short months. The economy was in the toilet. His party's key enforcer, House Majority Leader Tom the Hammer DeLay, was indicted and quit Congress. His vice president's chief of staff was indicted, as was Republican Uber lobbyist Jack Abramoff, White House domestic policy advisor Claude Allen, and the administration's chief procurement officer, David Safavian. For Bush, none of this was a problem that propaganda couldn't solve. Bush had used deception and disinformation to get us into a war. He would do the same to bail himself out of political trouble. Since coming to power, the Bush administration has engaged in a systematic campaign of covert propaganda aimed at subverting both domestic and foreign media. The Government Accountability Office estimates that between 2003 and 2005, the administration spent $1.6 billion on advertising and public relations to promote its policies. The subterfuge against U.S. media has been remarkable for its breadth and for how similar the propaganda has been to standard media coverage. In Iraq, the challenge for the Bush administration was not how to rebuild the country, a task that the U.S. has largely abandoned. No, the challenge was to get Iraqis to cheer up. So, in the middle of last year, good news started to appear in Iraqi newspapers. One headline blared, "More money goes to Iraq's development." Another headline gushed, "The sands are blowing toward a democratic Iraq." One article reported cheerily, quote, "As the people and the Iraqi security forces work together, Iraq will finally drive terrorism out of Iraq for good." The stories, made to appear as if they were written by independent Iraqi journalists, were in fact written by American information operations troops as part of a multi-million dollar covert Pentagon operation to plant propaganda in the Iraqi media. Cash-strapped Iraqi newspapers were paid from $50 to $2,000 to run a story. The propaganda was useful not in Iraq, where they could see right through it, but in the United States. In the absence of real progress in Iraq, the illusion would do fine for the Bush administration. And so Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld hailed the thriving, independent, pro-American Iraqi media as one of the great byproducts of the Iraqi invasion. In November 2005, Rumsfeld declared that Iraq's free media offered a, quote, relief valve for the Iraqi public to debate current issues. The Pentagon propaganda campaign is being waged as the State Department is offering programs in basic journalism skills and media ethics to Iraqi journalists. One workshop was titled, "The Role of Press in a Democratic Society." A senior Pentagon official who was opposed to planning the stories said, "Every speech we give in that country is about democracy, and we're breaking all the first principles of democracy when we're doing it." Well, it was very illuminating to see the film on Fallujah because it's something that we look into in our book, and we have a chapter called Unembedded in Fallujah. It is shocking the degree to which Americans are ignorant about the devastation that was rained on that city, not to mention the rest of Iraq. And part of what is going on, of course, is the whole embedding process, or as we called it in our last book, having reporters in bed with the military. And when you have reporters in bed with the military, they have one view only of the Iraq, of the nation of Iraq. That's the view through a gun sight. You don't get the view that we just saw, the view on the target end, the view from the victim's end. So here's a little bit about what we say. The chapter focuses on some interviews that Amy did with some of the only unembedded reporters who are in Fallujah. They work for Al Jazeera. But I'll just read you the introduction to that chapter. In 2004, the United States launched two major assaults on Fallujah, the Sunni city west of Baghdad that had come to symbolize Iraqi resistance to the U.S. occupation. The first offensive was in April 2004, and it came a few days after four American military contractors from the private security firm Blackwater USA were brutally killed in the city. The second assault took place in November 2004. In that attack, a U.S. military spokesman later confirmed to Democracy Now! That U.S. troops used white phosphorus, a chemical that can be used for illumination and obscuring troop movements, or as an incendiary weapon like napalm that melts the skin. This offensive use may violate international law. It was this second invasion, the November 2004 invasion, that was depicted in the film. The attacks on Fallujah were an extraordinary action by the U.S. military. As Marty Hyken, co-chair of the National Lawyers Guild Military Task Force, declared while filing a lawsuit against the military to obtain information about the assaults, quote, not since the destruction of Guernica in Spain in 1937, the Warsaw Ghetto in 1942, Nagasaki, Hiroshima, or Dresden in 1945, has there been such a total devastation of a city the size of Cincinnati or Oakland, housing 350,000 people or more. Having no apparent reason other than a show of power and a demand for revenge for four civilian American security contractors, the Bush government unmercifully leveled one of the largest cities in Iraq. The U.S. military made clear that revenge was its motive in attacking Fallujah in April 2004. Brigadier General Mark Kimmett, the U.S. military spokesman in Baghdad, declared, "We will pacify that city. We will be back in Fallujah. It will be at the time and place of our choosing." The siege that followed was one of the bloodiest assaults of the U.S. occupation. In 2 weeks that April, 30 Marines were killed as local guerrillas resisted U.S. attempts to capture the city. Some 600 Iraqis died and over 1,000 were wounded. The American military insisted that there were almost no civilian casualties among the Iraqis reported killed, despite the fact that fierce fighting raged in the heart of a densely populated city. Marine Lieutenant Colonel Brennan Byrne said, "What I think you will find is 95% of those were military-age males that were killed in the fighting. The Marines are trained to be precise in their firepower. The fact that there are 600 dead goes back to the fact that the Marines are very good at what they do." Embedded American reporters described the firefights from the vantage point of the Marines. As Jeffrey Gettleman reported in the New York Times, quote, "The Marines were pros. Nobody panicked. They crawled behind a berm, got on their knees, and judiciously fired back, bullet after bullet. We escaped that firefight with no casualties, but soon we were in another, and then another. The countryside was so lush and pretty, but it was swarming with insurgents." A lance corporal told me afterward, quote, "Man, I think some of those guys were kids, or they were midgets." Al Jazeera had some of the only unembedded journalists inside the besieged city, and its exclusive footage was being broadcast by every network from CNN to the BBC. Al Jazeera's reporting enraged the U.S. government. To the Bush administration, determined to control the flow of information, Al Jazeera had to be taken out. No one could imagine how far this would go. In a White House meeting with British Prime Minister Tony Blair on April 16, 2004, George W. Bush actually proposed bombing Al Jazeera's international headquarters in Qatar. This revelation came from top-secret minutes of the Bush-Blair summit leaked to Britain's Daily Mirror in November 2005. The British government swiftly invoked the Official Secrets Act and banned the Daily Mirror and any British media outlet from publishing further details of the leaked document. Two civil servants were arrested for leaking the memo. Blair was apparently able to persuade Bush to abandon the idea of incinerating the Al Jazeera headquarters, but the U.S. maintained its offensive against the Arab News Network. On April 9, 2004, the Bush administration demanded that Al Jazeera leave Fallujah as a precondition for a ceasefire. Al Jazeera initially refused. This story goes on. The Al Jazeera correspondent in Baghdad, Tariq Ayub, was killed by a U.S. bombing run on the air. Al Jazeera facilities were bombed throughout Iraq and in Afghanistan. This is the price that is paid for being unembedded. As Bush said early on, you're either with us or against us. And this, no one has suffered that, the wrath of that and seeing the truth of that, quite like journalists, certainly the civilians in Iraq have, but journalists have also been targets of this campaign. Well, some of the other things we write about in the book are when you get to write a book, you get to look into things you've heard rumors about over the years, but find sort of incredible. And, well, we finally got to look into one of them is the role of the CIA in the newsrooms. And in a chapter we have called The Mighty Wurlitzer, we detail some 30 years during which the CIA had been paying reporters and where top journalists, over 400 top journalists in this country and 800 news organizations, worked very closely with the CIA to go on assignments undercover as journalists and to spread disinformation. And you can read some of the more of the details of that. we need a different kind of media in this country. As we write in our introduction, it's a sad day when the government no longer has to cover up its dishonesty because the American media does it for them. This is the state of the corporate media today. It's a symptom of what we call the access of evil, journalists trading truth for access. The public unwittingly mistakes the illusion of news for reality. This also applies to the one-sided debates that are the rage on the networks and cable news. Viewers don't even know what they don't know. A study done by FAIR in the run-up to the Iraq War illustrates this point. In the 2 weeks surrounding Colin Powell's infamous 2003 speech to the UN, in which he made the case for the invasion that was to occur 6 weeks later, 393 so-called experts appeared on the major nightly network news shows. Of these, three, less than 1%, were leaders of anti-war organizations. So if you, like me, were glued to the TV in those few weeks and you maybe needed to go to the bathroom or something, you just missed the only person who thought like you did on the evening news. We can't even call this a mainstream media. It's an extreme media, a media that cheerleads for war. Instead of learning from the media what is actually going on in the world, we get static. A veil of distortion, lies, omissions, and half-truths that obscure reality. As bodies pile up in Iraq and New Orleans, many people are mystified, wondering where it went so wrong. We need a media that creates static of another kind, what the dictionary defines as criticism, opposition, or unwanted interference. Instead of a media that covers for power, we need a media that covers the movements that create static and make history. Now, with lives and freedoms on the line, we need a media that cuts through the lies and fakery that obscures the truth. A media that is fiercely independent, unembedded, journalism that works to inform, not to deceive. The soldiers and civilians in harm's way in Iraq deserve no less. The citizens of the devastated and abandoned Gulf Coast are counting on it, and the people shackled in America's secret gulags cry out for it. Free speech is democracy's last line of defense. We must demand it, defend it, and most of all, use it now. Thank you. Thanks. Well, that is an appropriate note to introduce somebody who has been demanding, defending, and using free speech for the last 10 years, because we are also celebrating on this trip the 10th birthday of Democracy Now!, my amazing sister Amy.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be with you today. It's wonderful to be celebrating your own community radio station here on campus at Santa Barbara. Not every community has a community radio station, and it's to be cherished, protected by supporting it, because independent media is absolutely critical in a time of war. Well, thanks very much to Mark Manning for that remarkable film. I look forward to seeing the extended version, how rarely in this country we see the true images of war. This is something we have to demand. It's not just public radio and television that use the public airwaves. The networks do too, NBC, ABC, CBS, and they have a responsibility to bring out the full spectrum of opinion and images, and if they don't do this, their licenses should be revoked. Yeah. Well, this has been an amazing journey. We call it our Breaking the Sound Barrier Tour, going through 80 cities. We began actually on Labor Day weekend in Cape Cod. I began in Provincetown and then headed to Nantucket. Nantucket is an amazing place, an historic place. It's where Frederick Douglass gave one of his first addresses against slavery for abolition. He trembled when he spoke. His body shook. His power was in speaking from his own experience. He had been enslaved as a child. He'd been enslaved as a teenager, and he was almost broken by a man named Edward Covey. Covey's place in the eastern shore of Maryland was called Mount Misery. Other slave owners would give troublesome slaves to Covey to break. Frederick Douglass almost lost his life, but he fought back, and he ultimately escaped and went north and changed the world. Mount Misery today is owned by Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. It's his vacation home. He bought it in 2003 to be near his close friend, Vice President Dick Cheney, a quarter mile down the road. That's what I was thinking about in Nantucket. The night before, I was in Provincetown. There we were celebrating WOMR. In each city that we stop, we tried to hold a fundraiser for the local community media. There it was WOMR, Outermost Radio. And the event took place at Provincetown High School. It was just about dusk, and we drove up. And there was a pickup truck in front of the school, and there was a couple standing next to it. And as I came up to the stairs to go in, I saw in the truck bed there was a coffin. The couple was named Carlos and Melita Arredondo, and they spoke very quickly as I was going in to tell their story. Carlos said it was August 25th, 2004. He and his wife had moved to Florida a little while before, and it was Carlos's 46th birthday. He was home with his mother. Melita was out, and he saw a Marine van pull up. And he thought, oh, maybe this is my son, Alex. Maybe he's come back from Iraq to surprise me for my birthday. Well, two Marines got out of the van, and they informed Carlos that Alex, his son, was dead. 20 years old, 20 days, died in the ancient Iraqi city of Najaf. Carlos lost his mind. He went into a frenzy. He begged the Marines to leave. He said they didn't. He asked them again. They didn't. He raced into the garage. He got some cans of gas. He got a blowtorch. He asked them to leave again. They didn't. He went to their van, and he started to try to destroy it. And he poured gasoline inside. He got gasoline on himself. His mother ran out to the van and was trying to pull him out of the van, and that triggered the torch, and it blew up the van, and Carlos was blown out onto the ground in his front lawn burning. It was then that Melita, his wife, pulled up in the car and saw her husband burning and learned that her stepson, Alex, was dead. Just about that point, Brian, their younger son, 17, who was vacationing in Maine, called up to wish his dad a happy birthday. And somehow someone hit on the phone and he heard the commotion. There was already press coming, and he turned on the TV. And he saw his father burning on the front lawn and learned that his older brother, the brother that he emulated, that he loved, the brother he wanted to be like, was dead. One story, no judgment, one story in a time of war. Now, it took Carlos a long time to heal. Physically was the easy part. He was burned on over a quarter of his body, but that was the least of it. It's his psyche. It's his emotions. It's his heart. that he has a long way to go healing. But 1 year later, the summer of 2005 in August, Cindy Sheehan went to Crawford and Carlos Arredondo found his voice. Cindy Sheehan was speaking at the Dallas Veterans for Peace Convention on August 5th. And as she gave this address, it was quite spontaneous. She said she couldn't enjoy another vacation because she had lost her son, Casey Sheehan, on April 4th, 2004. She says 40404. And she decided she would go to President Bush's vacation home to ask the commander-in-chief one question. For what noble cause did my son die? She said she just wanted an hour of the president's time. And she figured, well, she didn't really know where Crawford was, but she was in Dallas and she was in Texas anyway. How far could it be? And so the next morning, she made her way with some veterans for peace. And again, like David, I want to commend the veterans who are in the audience today, especially those we just saw at the Santa Barbara Pier. What a powerful display, straightforward, just the facts, just the remembrances of those who have died as we hit the number 2,700 soldiers in Iraq. Hundreds more in Afghanistan. In fact, this weekend we just passed the number of people killed September 11th in New York, in Washington, and in Pennsylvania, the number of soldiers who have died. Cindy Sheehan went to Crawford, and she took up residence in the ditch just outside the presidential estate. I won't call it a ranch because it isn't one. And she just kept asking the question. Now, the White House press corps is not exactly known for its independence, the embedded press corps. But beware of even that group of reporters. In the dead of a Texas summer, 110-degree weather day after day, with the president on one of the longest vacations in presidential history, not enjoying that access of evil, as we call it, trading truth for access. And so they started to hear what Cindy Sheehan was saying, and they put the question to the president, why aren't you meeting with this mourning mother? And President Bush responded. That's the power of the press. He's got to respond if they ask the question. And he responded, I've got to get on with my life too. And the Atlanta Journal-Constitution reported that day that he went mountain bike riding for 2 hours. He fished, he napped, he took in a Little League luncheon, and I think they said he did a little reading. But he didn't have time for Cindy Sheehan. But she kept at it, this persistent, relentless woman. The White House press corps said to her, why haven't you spoken out before? You're so eloquent. You're so articulate. She said, I have been speaking out. You just haven't been listening. Now, if you listen to Democracy Now! Or watch Democracy Now!, how many of you listen here? How many of you watch the program? On Dish Network or DirecTV? On the internet at democracynow.org. We're also at Free Speech TV 9415. We're at Link TV 9410 on Dish Network. And also on DirecTV channel 375. But what we're trying to do is build the largest public media collaboration in this country. We're now broadcasting on over 500 radio and television stations. We are also podcasting, video and audio podcasting. Time magazine just said Democracy Now! And Tim Russert's Meet the Press and NBC are the two pick of the podcasts, the most popular podcasts in the country. I don't know what Tim Russert's show is doing there, but And we also broadcast our headlines in Spanish, and you can get those at our website as well as the transcripts. But it is remarkable, the growth of Democracy Now. 2 to 3 news stations a week are picking it up. NPR stations, as well as PBS stations, as well as community and low-power FM stations, college stations, across Canada, across Australia, Europe, throughout North and South America as well. There is a hunger for independent voices, not just that small circle of pundits who know so little about so much, explaining the world to us and getting it so wrong. And so Cindy said, I have been speaking. Democracy Now! Was down in Washington for the inauguration of George Bush in 2005, that very cold, nasty January, very bad weather in Washington that eve of the inauguration. And Cindy Sheehan was there. She was there with Celeste Zapala. Celeste Zapala lost her son, Sherwood Baker, first Pennsylvania National Guardsman to die since World War II. Cindy and Celeste helped to found Gold Star Families for Peace. And they had called ahead to the Pentagon. They wanted to meet with Donald Rumsfeld. They didn't get a response. They decided they'd go anyway, and a small pilgrimage of them made their way to the Pentagon parking lot where they were stopped. Not by an envoy who said, the secretary's not available, but can I take a message, a note, or just tell me what you'd like to say to him? Instead, they were met by the black-clad Pentagon security, who turned these mourning mothers back at gunpoint. Well, beware of mothers who have nothing left to lose. And so, a few months later, they headed to Crawford. And Cindy became a magnet for so many people. The media also misses the movements people come from and are inspired by, and the movements they in turn inspire. In fact, Cindy Sheehan, even after Casey had died, she wasn't sure what to do either. It was Veterans for Peace, I think, that drew Cindy out. I believe it was Mother's Day that she said she wanted to be no other place than at Arlington West. And there is a cross for Casey Sheehan that we saw just at sunset today that has a little pink stuffed animal. That was Casey's as a child. And then when we were in Oakland just about a week ago, another Vet for Peace told us they invited Cindy to come for Independence Day that weekend. And she said she didn't want to talk. She wasn't ready for that, but she'd like to listen. By the end of that weekend, she was talking, and she hasn't stopped. And she has, and what the media misses is that context, both the historical context and the respect for movements, as if somehow movements take away from an individual action, when in fact they enhance and they explain. Just read Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States to truly understand the mechanism of history. And I can think of other people who have been misrepresented, like Rosa Parks, the great pioneer who died this past year, the only African-American woman to lie in state in the rotunda. And we went down for her memorial service in Washington, D.C. A few days later, she was buried in Detroit. And the media did cover that, absolutely. And a lot of kids know who Rosa Parks was. But the media still got it wrong. They talked about this remarkable woman who on December 1st, 1955, in Montgomery, sat down on the bus and refused to get up when a white bus driver told her to get up for a white passenger. She sat down to stand up, not just for African Americans, but for all of us, because if any one of us is diminished, we all are. But where the media got it wrong is they said that she was a tired seamstress, not a troublemaker. Yes, she was tired, but she was a first-class troublemaker. She had been secretary of the local NAACP, worked with Edie Nixon. He was president of the NAACP, came out of radical labor politics. Together, they had fought segregation. She'd gone to the Highlander Center, where she had trained and strategized over the best, most effective way to take on racial inequality. And she came back and she'd sat down on that bus before and refused to get up. But this was a tipping point. And this is also something I think that should give us hope. There are moments in history. Who can quite explain why they change things so dramatically? Sometimes it's a small thing, not the biggest thing a person engages in, but there is a moment. And what matters is all the work that so many people put in before to lay the foundation. And this was that tipping point that launched the modern-day civil rights movement that helped to launch Dr. Martin Luther King as well. And to show Rosa Parks' bravery, just a few months before, Emmett Till, the 14-year-old boy who'd been sent down by his mother, Mamie Till Mobley, from Chicago to get out of the summer heat and be with his family in Money, Mississippi. He was lynched by a white mob. They said he had wolf-whistled at a white woman, this 14-year-old boy. Not even clear exactly what happened, even today, more than 50 years later, because it wasn't adequately investigated. He ends up in the bottom of the river. And his mother did an unbelievably brave thing. When the casket was being sent up to Chicago, she said, "I want that casket open for his wake." And there you saw Emmett's head brutalized, 5-10 times larger than it should have been. And she wanted the world to see the ravages of racism, the brutality of bigotry. And thousands stream past Emmett's body. And Jet Magazine and other black publications published those pictures, and they were seared in the memory, in the history of this nation. Mamie Till Mobley has something to teach the press today about showing the images. We interviewed the former CNN host, Aaron Brown, on Democracy Now! For an hour, and I asked him, where are the pictures of Iraq? Like those we saw in Vietnam that helped end the war, the girl burning with napalm, naked, running down the street. Would we see those pictures today? And why aren't we seeing them? I asked him. He said it's a matter of taste. I think it's war that's tasteless. It is so important that the American people get to see the effect of foreign policy, because Americans are a compassionate people, if they know. They are good media consumers, but that doesn't mean they will know, given the lack of images that we have seen. If you look at, for example, one day when the statue of Saddam Hussein went down and Firdaus Square in Baghdad. Remember, the Marines pulled it down with a rope. The Marines were just outside the picture frame, but you kept seeing that statue go down thousands of times in U.S. press. Actually, the Wall Street Journal did an interesting piece on the contrast of what was seen in the rest of the world and here. The proof of the conscious sanitizing of the images for American consumption is looking at CNN, because they have two networks. They have CNN International and they have CNN Domestic. Same corporation. They pull their pictures from the same pool. Now, CNN Domestic that day in April 2003 showed that image of Saddam Hussein going down thousands of times like the other networks. I'm sure that is the emblematic image for Americans of the invasion of Iraq, because we saw it so many times. But CNN International knew they could not get away with just showing that. And so they showed a split screen. And on one side of the screen was the statue going up and down. But on the other, they showed the images of war. Instead, what we get from the American press are, for example, the fireworks display of bombs over Baghdad. I asked Aaron Brown, where are the other images? He said, didn't you know CNN got kicked out? I said, but you take Al Jazeera's bombs over Baghdad images, you know you have access to the whole pool, yet you don't choose to show those. It's our responsibility as journalists to go to where the silence is. Back to Cindy and what she has done. Certainly one who has filled that silence and drawn so many out. I think of the many women who went to Crawford, a place that will forever now be known as Cindy's Crawford. Hundreds and then thousands of people went last summer of 2005. Women like Nadja McCaffrey, who lives outside Sacramento, and her son Patrick, after 9/11, felt he had the perfect life, wife, two kids, wanted to give back to his country, serve in a time when the country was under attack or natural catastrophe, and so he joined the National Guard. And then he was called up to go to Iraq, and he couldn't understand the connection. He signed up to protect his country if it was attacked. But what did that have to do with going to Iraq? He sat with his mother for hours. She urged him not to go, but he decided to. He wanted to protect his buddies, the others in his unit. Now, I come from New York. I come from the state of Governor George Pataki. He went and visited Iraq. He came back. He said that he wants to take a piece of the statue of Saddam Hussein and embed it in the foundation of a new World Trade Center. If he does that, it will be the first proven link between 9/11 and Iraq. But Patrick went to Iraq. He sent home for deflated soccer balls and candy to give to the kids. Ultimately, he died there. And when his casket was sent home, Nadja McCaffrey invited all the press to Sacramento International Airport, the photographers, the videographers, the filmmakers. You know, President Bush has invoked this executive order that says you can't film, videotape, photograph the flag-draped coffins or body bags coming home. But Nadja said no. She said, "My son didn't go to Iraq in darkness. He's not going to return in darkness." And that's how she chose to memorialize her son. She made her way to Crawford last summer. And then there was Patricia Roberts. She lost her son, Jamal Addison. He was the first Georgian National Guardsman to die since World War II. And she set up a fund because she wanted to ensure that African-American kids don't feel they have to detour through Iraq to get a college education. And then there was Becky Lowry, State Senator Becky Lowry from Minnesota. I learned about her two Memorial Days ago. I was driving through Minneapolis going up to Ashland, Wisconsin to give the commencement address at Northland College, and I picked up the Pioneer Press in Minneapolis, and there was a headline that said Death in the Family. And it was about this state senator, Becky Lowry, who before the invasion had introduced an anti-war resolution and then confronted Donald Rumsfeld at a national conference of state legislators on the issue of no-bid contracts going to Halliburton and doing no good for the soldiers in Iraq. But that wasn't about, really, what the article was about. It was about her son, Matt, who just died in Iraq, Matt Lowry, that Memorial Day, two Memorial Days ago. We went to Crawford to interview the people who were at, well, what became known as Camp Casey. And Becky Lowry, State Senator Lowry, said, "With all of our children dying, who will be our future leaders?" Well, I think Becky and Cindy, Patricia and Nadja, these mourning mothers, these grieving women, are the future leaders of this country. Back to the Arredondos, Carlos and Melita. Carlos now having chosen to drag a coffin around the country, his symbol to remind people of what is still continuing to happen. It truly is astounding. As we saw at the Santa Barbara Pier today, 2,700 soldiers have died. You know that the U.S. has been in Iraq now longer than the U.S. was involved with World War II. And Carlos Sarandando can't stop now. He drags a coffin around, sometimes a miniature one, sometimes a full-size one. He went to the Capitol. There are many pictures of him speaking with Congress members. He was in Waco, Crawford. He came up to Provincetown. This was Labor Day weekend, the last weekend before people go back to work, the big party time, and there he was with this coffin. And everyone stopped who saw it. He said, "The war isn't taking a vacation, so neither can I." And he had all these documents and loose leaf notebooks that I was looking through, and one of them was a letter from the National Guard. Carlos and Melita said that their younger son, Brian, who was 17 when Alex died, now 19, is being aggressively recruited to go to Iraq. And the letter said, "Dear American," was from the National Guard. And it started by talking about how you can serve your country in times like Katrina. Now, that was particularly interesting, given that this 1 year ago, the drowning of an American city, more than 1,500 people of New Orleans dying, which certainly did not have to happen. But the National Guard were in Iraq. So to invoke Katrina as a reason to join the National Guard was interesting. I mean, you think about what happened last year. You had Cindy bookending President Bush's extended vacation. And the other bookend was this horrific hurricane. Right at the end of August, the hurricane, and then the levees breaking. You know, President Bush was fully briefed by video conference on this hurricane possibly being the big one, the whopper that could wipe out New Orleans. Now, no one could be sure. But they certainly thought there was a very strong possibility. What did President Bush do? He headed out from Crawford to New Orleans, to Washington, to command and control. No, he headed right in this area. He headed to California. And the press photographed him, the kind of photographs he encouraged, photographed him riffing on the guitar of the country music star Mark Wills. Will's signature song is "Wish You Were Here," could have been the theme song of the people of New Orleans. And then President Bush headed back to Crawford to vacation. But it wasn't only Bush who didn't respond. Vice President Dick Cheney was in Wyoming fishing Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, I believe. Didn't leave until Thursday's. Condoleezza Rice was in my city, the Secretary of State in New York, doing some high-end shoe shopping at Ferragamo. A customer shouted at her, "What are you doing shopping when people are dying in New Orleans?" They took her out, the customer, that is. She went to a Broadway show, Spamalot. She played tennis with Monica Seles. And then there was Andrew Card, the former chief of staff. He was vacationing in New England, the former GM lobbyist before he was chief of staff. You know what we're seeing in Washington is the ascendancy of the oligarchy. That's right. President Bush, a failed oil man. Vice President Dick Cheney, former head of the largest oil services corporation in the world, Halliburton. Vice Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice served on the board of Chevron for more than 10 years, actually had an oil tanker named after her, the Condoleezza Rice. And Andrew Card, the GM lobbyist. Is it any accident how foreign policy is being conducted? Oil politics from Iraq to Venezuela. You know, the joke of the little boy asking his father, "What's our oil doing under their sand?" And so you have this hurricane. And a side effect of the Bush administration not responding, would you call it reckless neglect, criminal neglect? Does it have anything to do, I hope not, with New Orleans being a majority African-American city? It's the cultural capital of this country, perhaps the world. But a side effect of the administration not responding was that when the corporate media did the right thing, they headed to New Orleans, there were no troops to embed with. And we saw, perhaps for one of the first times, corporate media reporting from the victim's perspective. You'd see the bodies floating by. The Bush administration leaped into action. They tried to say you can't film the bodies, to which the editor of the Times-Picayune responded, "You've got to be kidding." I remember seeing a young woman reporter interviewing a man. She was in the water, and he walked up in the water with his boy. And he said he'd been in his attic holding onto his wife's hand, and as her hand slipped out of his, she said, "Take care of the children." He told the reporter this, and then he just walked off in shock, waded into the water, and the young reporter started to cry. That's reporting from the victim's perspective. That's what unembedded reporting looks like. And the effect on this nation was electric. It galvanized the country. It didn't matter if you're a conservative Republican or a progressive or a Democrat or an independent. It was irrelevant. These distinctions anyway are breaking down in this country. When you look at war, when you look at issues of privacy and corporate control, those divisions are really not relevant anymore. And people were horrified. They responded, their humanity responding to the humanity. Could you imagine if for just 1 week we saw those same images in Iraq? We saw the babies dead on the ground. We saw the women with their legs blown off from cluster bombs either in Iraq or Lebanon. We saw the soldiers dead and dying. For 1 week, Americans are a compassionate people. They would say, no, war is not the answer to conflict in the 21st century. That is why it is so important that we have an honest, unembedded, independent media. I wanted to tell you the story of Raed Jarar. Some of you heard it if you are listening to the radio, but he was on our program a few weeks ago. He's the Iraqi architect, the blogger who did raedinthemiddle.blogspot.com describing what was happening in Iraq. A very interesting analysis. But anyway, he has a green card. He's in this country. He lives here. And he was flying from Kennedy back home to San Francisco a few weeks ago, or he thought he was. And he went to Kennedy Airport, and he was about to get on the flight, and he said he was surrounded by four security, JetBlue and TSA. And they told him he couldn't get on the flight wearing the T-shirt that he was wearing. You know how when you wake up in the morning, you throw something on, you can't even remember what it is, and you looked at T-shirt. Oh, it was a black T-shirt, and it had white letters, and it said, "We will not be silent." And so he said, "What's wrong with my T-shirt?" And they said it was threatening. And they said, "What's threatening about we will not be silent?" And they said, "It's not the English, it's the Arabic script above it." And he said, "Oh, well, that's we will not be silent in Arabic." And they said, "We don't have a translator, so we can't be sure." So he said, "Has Arabic become a terrorist language?" They said, "Wearing a T-shirt with Arabic script onto an American plane today is like walking into a bank with a T-shirt that says, 'I am a robber.'" They insisted he wasn't going to get on the plane with this T-shirt, and the JetBlue official went and got him a T-shirt to cover his up with. I think it said New York or I Love New York or something like that. Now, he had to ask, "Is this what I'm going to go down on? Is this what I'm going to be deported for?" He was arguing. He talked about his constitutional rights and being a taxpayer here in this country. But for all the things he had covered and written about, this was the thing. And he needed to get home. So he put on this cover-up T-shirt, and they escorted him on the plane before the other passengers. He had reserved his seat well in advance. He likes to sit in the front, but they took him to the back of the bus, plane. And then they brought the other passengers on. And that was the way Raed flew home to San Francisco. So a few days later, we had him on the show, and he described this whole thing that had happened. And the next day, some women came into Democracy Now! Studios. We work out of a 100-year-old firehouse just blocks from ground zero. It's why I get along with the fire marshals, I think, in all these events where they want to close it down because there are too many people. But we work out of this 100-year-old firehouse. We work in the bay, the first floor, where the horse and buggies used to take out the buckets of water. And these women came in, and they were all wearing this T-shirt, the black T-shirt with the white letters and the English and Arabic script, "We will not be silent." And I asked them what were they doing, and they said they were in a rush. They really couldn't talk. They were headed to the airport. And I asked them, "Where are you going?" And they said, "It doesn't matter. We're just getting on planes." So, anyway... when they came back, I interviewed one of them. Now, at this point, all the media had picked up the story of Ra'ed Jarar. And, I mean, they stole our story. They didn't give us credit, but it's okay, because the motto of Democracy Now! Is steal this story, please. We call it... We call it trickle-up journalism. So, Lori Arbeiter came on our show. She's the one who gave Ra'ed the T-shirt to begin with. They made it on the third anniversary of the invasion, this last March 20th. They started making these T-shirts, and now with the media doing covering this the way they are, they're doing a very brisk business. Thousands of T-shirts. You just go to, I think it's wewillnotbesilent@gmail.com. It's nothing fancy here. And they've now translated it into Arabic, into Farsi, into French, into Spanish, into Hebrew. And now, Lori says, they're translating it into the original German. Why German? Well, the phrase comes from World War II, the White Rose Collective. A brother and sister named Hans and Sophie Scholl. They weren't Jewish, they were German Christians. And in the face of the Nazi atrocity, what was happening to their Jewish neighbors, they thought, what can we do? And they decided to hand out pamphlets about what was happening so that the Germans could never say, we didn't know. The fourth series of pamphlets they handed out said across the top, "We will not be silent." Hans and Sophie Scholl were captured by the Nazis and murdered. But that philosophy, that motto, that phrase continues to this day, and it should be the Hippocratic oath of the media. We will not be silent. We will not allow others to be silenced. The media, I see, is a huge kitchen table that stretches across this country, that we all sit around and debate and discuss the most important issues of the day. War and peace, life and death. And anything less than that is a disservice to a democratic society. Anything less than that is a disservice to the servicemen and women of this country. I wanted to tell you another T-shirt story. It's the story of Stephen and Roger Downs. They went to a mall upstate New York. It was on the eve of the invasion. And, well, they did the patriotic thing. They went shopping. And they went to a T-shirt store and bought T-shirts. The father, very radical T-shirt. It said, "Peace on Earth." And the son got one more specific. It said something like, "No war with Iraq and let the inspections work." And they put on their T-shirts and... Then they went to the food court to get something to eat. And before they knew it, a security guard had come up to them and told them if they didn't take off the T-shirts, they would be arrested. There was no protesting allowed in the mall. So Stephen Downs, the father, protested. He said, "I bought this T-shirt here in the mall." And before he could swallow his food, this retired attorney with the State Commission on Judicial Misconduct was in handcuffs. 3 days later, 150 T-shirt wearers descended on the mall. Security locked themselves in their offices. And the charges against attorney Stephen Downs were dropped. It It's a lesson to all of us. We don't have to agree with each other. Last week I was in Baraboo, Wisconsin at the Fighting Bob Fest, and a girl came up to me. She's a high school kid wearing a sweatshirt. She was, and her sweatshirt said, "Great minds don't think alike," which I thought was very good. But we don't have to agree with each other. But we do have to stand together to make it harder for any individual or any population to be targeted. After Ra'ed's story got big, MSNBC invited me on to tell Ra'ed's story. And then they asked, but, you know, whether we like it or not, don't we need racial profiling in times like today? Because we have to be concerned about our national security. And I said, actually, no. Racial profiling threatens our national security. And for a number of reasons. When you marginalize, when you alienate, when you target populations, the most targeted now in this country are Muslims, Arab Americans, people of South Asian descent. When you make them second-class citizens in your own country, think of the effect not only on the populations here, but how the rest of the world sees us. But also, practically, I said, if you racially profile today, you're going to miss the next Timothy McVeigh. Right? This horrible terror attack in the Oklahoma City building. And at that time, when he was caught, when McVeigh was caught, and it was clear he worked with some other people, did anyone say that we need to round up all white, Christian, blue-eyed, blonde-haired men in this country? No. If you believe in law and order, if you think, if the authorities think someone is guilty, you have to gather the evidence, you charge that person, you try him, and if he is found guilty by a jury of his peers, well then, he should be punished. That's what law and order is. It's why, by the way, I think conservative and liberal lines are breaking down right now. And when you look at what this country is coming to represent, when you look at torture, this extraordinary term, extraordinary rendition, which is White House for kidnapping, or we understand it from Latin America, disappearing people. Maher Arar this past week, the Canadian citizen, who in 2002 is going through Kennedy Airport after a summer vacation, and he is taken by U.S. authorities, imprisoned here for a few weeks, then sent to Syria, where he is tortured. He weeps all the way in this torture flight, this U.S. security flight, a Gulfstream jet that he is sent to Syria on, saying, if I am returned to Syria, he'd been born there, he left, fled when he was 17 with his family. He said, I will surely be tortured. He was kept in a cell no larger than a grave for almost a year, and as inexplicably as he was taken, he was released after almost a year. A broken man returned to Canada. For what reason? Here you had President Bush this past week at the United Nations General Assembly talking about Syria as the crossroads for terrorism, and yet the U.S. is walking hand in hand with Syria when it comes to torture. This past week, a Canadian state judicial commission found that Maher Arar was completely innocent, and they slammed the U.S. government for these practices. It's extraordinary rendition. It's torture. It's illegal detention that threatened the national security of this country, that threatened us as Americans. Because if we are a model of behavior for the rest of the world, as I think Americans are proud to be, if we are a model of behavior and practices, what will happen to Americans, regular citizens, soldiers, officials, if they go to other parts of the world and in those countries, they model that behavior. They say they're doing it the American way. No, I think America is better than this. I'm just going to end with September 11th, because this is the fifth anniversary. We've just passed it. And I think there are such important lessons and answers that we can draw from as we pull together now. September 11th, 2001, a horrific moment 3,000 people incinerated in an instant. We'll never know how many people died on that day, because those who go uncounted in death go uncounted in life, and they were the undocumented workers who worked at the World Trade Center. And we should know their names, we should know their stories. That's what dignifies a life. But what a horrific day it was. The first plane hit the first tower at 8:47. Second plane hit at 9:03. Democracy Now! Was brought. We broadcast at 8 every morning now. We broadcast then at 9. And so when the first plane hit, we didn't know what had happened. We worked out of the attic at the time of this firehouse, no windows. We prepared for the show. The show went on at 9. Second plane hit. We still didn't know what was unfolding just outside our door, where the closest national broadcast to Ground Zero. We were doing a special that day. We were doing a special between the connection of terror and September 11th, 1973, the day Salvador Allende died in the palace in Chile as the Pinochet forces rose to power, the U.S.-backed Pinochet forces, Nixon-backed, Kissinger-backed, ITT-backed Pinochet forces rose to power, leading to the deaths of thousands of Chileans over the next 17 years. It's not the first time September 11th was connected to that date. September 11th, 1990, Guatemala, the anthropologist Myrna Mack died at the hands of Guatemalan security forces. Unfortunately, U.S.-backed Guatemalan security forces. September 11th, 1977, Steve Biko in South Africa, founder of the Black Consciousness Movement, being beaten to death in the back of a van by apartheid forces, U.S.-backed apartheid forces. He died in the early morning hours of September 12th. A few days ago on this Breaking the Sound Barrier tour, we were in Minneapolis, and I learned that September 12th was Leonard Peltier's birthday. Leonard Peltier, the Native American leader who's been imprisoned for decades. In fact, that day I was in Minneapolis, I met his attorney, Mike Kuzma, who just come out of court, where they were appealing for 90,000 more documents, more pages of documents in his case. At the time of his trial decades ago, they had 1,800 pages. They thought that was it. Now they're appealing for 90,000 pages, and that's just from one office, one FBI office in Minneapolis. And they've been denied based on national security. National security. This trial took place 30 years ago. September 11, 1971, Attica, the uprising upstate New York, where 2 days later, Nelson Rockefeller, then the governor, called out the New York State troopers, and they opened fire, killing 39 men, among them guards. And just this past week, guards' families finally getting some compensation. They were lied to at the time of the uprising. They were told that it was the prisoners who killed their loved ones, the guards. But in fact, it turned out that a coroner's report had been suppressed, and that all of the guards had died as a result of the troopers opening fire, and also prisoners. 88 were critically wounded, and hundreds more were injured. September 11th is not the first time terror came to U.S. soil. Ask any African American about slavery. Ask any Native American about what's happened in this country. But it was horrific. 3,000 people gone. And in those days after September 11th, as we hunkered down in the firehouse, we were in the evacuation zone. The military police were pushing everyone out, but we felt it was critical to keep broadcasting as the war machine was gearing up in Washington, and the image of Americans being projected through the rest of the world through that corporate lens was so different than the one we were experiencing in New York. It wasn't a blood-curdling scream for revenge. There were these little stickers that went up that said, "Our grief is not a cry for war." And I think that better represented the thousands of people who went into the parks with flowers and candles to talk, to cry, to debate. What next? We broadcast the voice of Rita Lazar, 70 years old, lost her friend, her brother, Abe Zalmanowicz, on the 27th floor of the World Trade Center. He worked for Blue Cross Blue Shield. He was working next to his best friend, Ed, who is a paraplegic. Abe's brother screamed at him on the cell phone to get out now. And he said, "As soon as the emergency workers come up and help me bring Ed down, we'll go down together." And they died with so many others. And a few days later, President Bush gave his National Cathedral Address in Washington, invoked the story of Abe, and called him a national hero. And his sister, Rita, said no. And she wrote a letter to the New York Times that actually got published. And she said, even as she knew the worst pain of her life, it would only increase her suffering to know that a woman in Afghanistan would soon lose her brother. She said, "Not in my name, not in my brother's name." Phyllis and Orlando Rodriguez lost their son, Greg, above the 100th floor of the World Trade Center. He worked for Cantor Fitzgerald. They lost 700 of 1,000 workers. They wrote a letter to President Bush. It didn't get published, but it swirled around the internet. It said the same thing. Even as we suffer, it will not lessen our pain to know that a mother and father in Afghanistan will soon lose their son. Not in our name, not in our son's name. And a nationwide movement grew up. Not in our name, September 11th, Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. And sometimes we saw them on TV describing their loved ones. But when they moved from description to prescription, what should happen, the media cut away. And they brought us the terrorism experts, the Oliver Norths and the Henry Kissingers. Well, maybe the media got it right in that case. It takes one to know one. And I don't say that lightly. When you look at the record, when you look at Kissinger's support for Pinochet and the thousands of Chileans who died, when you look at the record in Argentina, his support for the generals and the dirty war and the tens of thousands of Argentines who died, when you look at Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam and the millions who died there, when you look at his involvement with the Indonesian dictator Suharto, going with President Ford the day before Indonesia invaded East Timor, giving the go-ahead for that invasion, 90% of the weapons used were from the United States. It led to one of the great genocides of the 20th century. When you look at the record, I do think that Osama bin Laden and his accomplices should be tried, and if found guilty, punished. But I also think that Henry Kissinger should be tried for war crimes. We have to have a uniform standard of justice. If it's not okay for them in other countries, it's not okay for us. It will make us all safer. I'll end with the image of all of those pictures that went up all over New York in those days after the attacks. The thousands of color Xeroxes of photographs of loved ones lost. Pictures of a woman holding her child, and it said, "If you've seen my wife last seen in Tower One, please call her husband," and a phone number. Or a picture of a young man, and it said, "If you've seen my son last seen in Tower Two, please call his father," and a phone number. And I thought of how similar those pictures were to those carried by on the placards by the mothers of the disappeared in Argentina as they walk the Plaza de Mayo. Have you seen my grandson? Have you seen my granddaughter? September 11th united us with people around the world against terror. Terror is the killing of innocent civilians, whether done by individuals or done by states. We live in the most powerful country on earth. What we do has a huge effect on the rest of the world. Whether we are journalists or students, whether we are professors or doctors or nurses or lawyers or veterans, whether we are artists, whether we are just beginning our careers or we've retired, whether we're employed or unemployed, we have a decision to make every day, every hour of every day. And that is whether to represent the sword or the shield. Democracy Now!